I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Alan Weber. He's an entrepreneur. He's a recent gubernatorial candidate in the Democratic Party. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you and talk to you. We wanted to talk today about an issue which is coming up in the legislature called, quote-unquote, right to work. Right to work is perhaps an odd terminology, but what does it refer to?
Right to work is a very odd terminology, and I think it would not pass the truth in advertising test if it had it applied to it, because people think right to work means it gives people the right to work. It doesn't. It has nothing to do with that. Right to work is a historical artifact from the 1940s designed to kneecap organized labor, designed to take away organized labor's strength to unionize organizations, and frankly to represent people whether they are members of a union or not. So here's how it works in a nutshell. In a state like New Mexico today, which is not a right-to-work state, if you go to work in a union shop, you're not required to join the union. Nobody can make you join the union, ever.
Because of this 1947 law.
Because of the 1947 law that said you don't have to join a union to work in a union shop. What you do have to pay for are the services the union provides for you. Because whether a union member or not, you do get the benefit of the union bargaining on your behalf, making sure your wages are fair, and actually representing you in case you get fired. So all of that you pay for with a small fee.
Now, how small are we talking about?
You know, I actually haven't looked at the numbers, but I would guess that it's the kind of thing that you get what you pay for. So in a union where there's high stakes for wages, benefits, pension, representation, you pay a little more. The thing is, if you take away that fee, which is what a right-to-work designation does, it says you don't pay anything.
Or you don't have to pay anything.
You are not required to pay anything, and frankly, if you're not required, people won't. What it does is to undermine the authority and the power of organized labor. It takes away the funds that labor uses to keep the union going. And so while it sounds on the surface like it's all about fairness and equity and choice, it's actually about undermining the union as a force for wages, benefits, pensions, and fairness in the workplace, including safety in the workplace. So you put it all together, and it is it's largely a piece of legislation driven by the Koch brothers directly. People throw the name the Koch brothers around like they're a mythic operation. There are Koch brothers, and this is what they do with their money. They try to influence legislation around America, regardless of what's going on in that state or in that community.
And the purpose of it from the Koch brothers and the proponents of the quote-unquote right-to-work legislation, what do they think is, why do they want to pass this legislation in the first place? What's in it for them?
What's in it for them are two things. Number one, profit motive. You make more money if you are free of having to bargain with organized labor, with a union. You have all the power on your side of the negotiation. So that's an economic instrument. Second is much more nefarious, and that's a political instrument. The goal is really to change the equation of politics in America, to take unions and organized labor out of the political process by taking away their ability to have any standing, any power, any legitimacy. And the more you undermine organized labor, the more the game tilts towards the libertarians, the Tea Party, the right-wing Republican interests around the country. So it's really a national effort. Folks may or may not have heard of something called ALEC, A-L-E-C, which is I like to call it a bill mill. It churns out bills that they then give to state legislatures.
American Legislative Exchange Committee.
Correct. So ALEC churns out these pieces of legislation, and willing and complicit legislators all over the country pick it up and say, oh, I have a great bill here. It'll make New Mexico a right-to-work state. That's simply how this legislation comes to be. It is not, it doesn't originate in New Mexico. It's not based on what's best for New Mexico. Has nothing to do with the interests of New Mexicans. It is a national effort to undermine organized labor as a bargaining force and as a political force.
Let's go back to the years before organized labor existed. We had an industrial revolution. We had factory workers. We had no unions. What did life look like for workers?
Well, if you go back, it depends on how far you want to go back. I'm a big fan of the Roosevelt family in all of its different forms and functions. So Teddy Roosevelt stepped up to the plate as really the first progressive in the United States on the national level. And Teddy looked at the trusts and said, this is unfair. There are unfair working conditions, there are dangerous circumstances, there's child labor. And Teddy tried to bust the trusts. And later, Franklin Roosevelt stepped up to the plate and passed what became known as the Wagner Act. This is in the mid-30s. And the Wagner Act said, we're in the middle of a depression. We have got to create a new bargain, a new deal between organized labor and people who run big companies so that there's more equity, more fairness. The work life of people is better. They get paid more fairly. They get working conditions that are fair. And FDR really championed this new deal that created the grounds for the creation of the middle class based on organized labor getting more of the benefits of work for the workers. Around 1947, the Republican Party never liked the New Deal. They never liked Franklin Roosevelt, and they didn't like labor. They tried to do away with as much of the New Deal as they could. In 1947, when Harry Truman's president, they succeeded in passing the Taft-Hartley Act. Now, history is alive and well in America. I mean, we're still living with these things, and we shouldn't just take them as ancient history. They're real.
One of the things that I think is important to point out is that a lot of the things that we take for granted are New Deal things, like 40-hour work week and days off and stuff like that.
Pensions, doing away with child labor, and frankly, the ability of unions to have standing. There were cases all over the country, in the West as well, where large corporations would hire scabs, they would try to break the union. In the history of Michigan, there was something called the Battle of the Overpass, where Henry Ford hired thugs and infiltrated the factories to try to undermine and scare and intimidate workers. This is part of the history of the United States, and we've walked away from it. We take certain things for granted, that people will get fair treatment, that there will be a certain number of hours per week, that there will be pensions, that there will be health care. This is stuff that had to be fought for.
And really, when I think about it, very few people have that now. I mean, we're working two jobs. We don't have pensions. We don't have health insurance. We don't have, I mean, there's not even that many full-time jobs anymore. Even among what were considered professions like academia, everybody's an adjunct now. A tenured professor retires and they hire an adjunct.
Yeah, no, the game keeps changing and the center of gravity shifts. And so you're right. The world of a job that you have at the end of which you get a watch and you're retired after your 40 years of hard work, those days are gone. The question is, how far do we want the pendulum to go the other direction so that the individual worker and his or her family is simply at the beck and call of whoever has the capital to run the game.
Which is kind of where we are now already?
Well, it's a mixed bag. We're in a huge, if you want to, I love this subject, which is the transition we're going through right now. We are reinventing our economy all the time, and the United States does it better than most countries. But there's a lot of people who get hurt in the process. There are a lot of people who got hurt when the Industrial Revolution took place. Now we're dealing with an entrepreneurial revolution and a global revolution of innovation and creativity. Who knows what 3D printing will do? Who knows what things like we were talking about earlier, Kickstarter, the ability to raise money at large from people who support you or like you. That's all new business, and it's changing the game. But there's a lot of damage on the, along the way. And the question is, for America, has always been, how do we treat people who are the most vulnerable? How do we make their lives less difficult? How do we even the scales so they have a shot? Right to work tilts the scales even more away from individuals, whether they're members of unions or not. Unions, if you look at the data, and they're really, this is not just a philosophical issue, this is a data-driven issue. The data say that in states where there are unions able to bargain collectively, everybody does better. Everybody has more protection. Everybody has safer working conditions. So undermining that is a real damaging thing to the fabric of any community.
And there are examples in, for example, Oklahoma, where Oklahoma was not a quote-unquote right-to-work state. Then they passed a law like that, and it had, I mean, it's hard to say that the consequences of it, which were negative, were because of right-to-work, but certainly right-to-work didn't help. What happened?
Well, let's flip it a little bit. The first thing you have to understand, and we're in the middle of this debate right now in the state legislature. That's why it's so critical. I mean,
right.
We are talking about something where New Mexico's future is on the line, and the Republicans in the legislature and the governor have outsourced our future to the Tea Party, the Koch brothers, and to ALEC.
Or are trying.
They're trying. They've allowed them to set the agenda. The claims that are being made in New Mexico are identical to the claims that were made in Oklahoma in 2001. And those claims are, number one, if you want to get more jobs to move to your state, you got to be a so-called right-to-work state. Number two, it's great for manufacturing in particular. It'll bring all those high-paying manufacturing jobs into your state. And number three, it's good for everybody. Everybody benefits by choice. Well, the facts are quite the contrary. Those claims don't stand up. So if you really were to say to the proponents of this measure, prove it, prove that it works, they can't do it. They cannot do it. The data in Oklahoma are that, in fact, manufacturing jobs left the state. Many of the companies that are attracted to this right-to-work movement are basically bottom feeders. They're looking for the lowest place to do business, lowest cost place to do business. We can't compete with China. If you want to be a bottom feeder, you're going to move to China. And in fact, 20,000 jobs moved from Oklahoma to China in the wake of Oklahoma becoming a so-called right-to-work state. That's a fact. That's, you can't prove that right-to-work is the reason. But what you can prove is it didn't live up to its promise. And if you can't live up to your promises, then what's the real point of the exercise? Why are you doing this? Then you get back to what you and I were talking about earlier, which is it's not really about job creation. It's not really about attracting businesses. It's about undermining the political process so that the far right, the Tea Party, the Koch brothers, have a higher chance of winning. It's money politics that's driving it.
And when we look at the institutions that support the various political parties, it would be a wonderful thing if individual citizens in the United States supported the political parties. If everybody put in $5, $10, $15, $20 and nobody was putting in $1 million, that would be great. Then we'd have something resembling democracy in the political process, or maybe we'd have public campaign financing and everybody starts with a kind of equal playing field and the different candidates qualify for that funding. What we have in reality is that citizens account for a negligible, like an insignificant amount of the actual funding that goes into national politics, and to a lesser extent state politics. The people who, or the institutions who are putting the money in, are extremely wealthy individuals like the Koch brothers, who tend to put it in on the Republican side, and then corporations and unions. And if you destroy unions, which is what this is, as far as I can tell, you're basically trying to destroy the one institution that supports one of the two parties in the two-party system.
Yeah. Now, I think if you strip away all of the political theater and you actually say, what is going on here, there is a big part of this that is simply trying to continue the process of political damaging the political process, undermining the fairness of the political process, having it be driven more and more by big money and an agenda that favors big money. If you think democracy is going to be a self-regulating system, I got bad news for you. It's not. It requires everybody's participation. So you're right. In a perfect world, we'd have people putting money into campaigns they care about. We'd have more people running for office and actually being part of the process individually. But what we've done, unfortunately, is by virtue of the Supreme Court with Citizens United, by virtue of the political process being perceived to be so damaging to the individual, we've outsourced politics to a very few people, and the economics of it have gone to favor even fewer people who have the big bucks and the agenda that they care deeply about, driving things in their own way. And more it turns out that that becomes a self-fueling system. And so an issue like right to work, you know, it is like you're peeling the layers of the onion. On the outside, you can talk about fairness and equity, choice, but when you get to the heart of the matter, it's destabilizing politics and undermining unions and the middle class.
We're talking to entrepreneur Alan Weber. When we look at the roots of what's going on here with the union and the anti-union movement, part of the anti-union movement has a racial component here in the U.S. Talk about that.
Yeah. We were talking about the layers of the onion. One of the very ugly layers of the right-to-work onion is something that its supporters never mention, and that is the really ugly racist history of the right-to-work movement. We're talking about history. This goes back to 1947. Congress overrides President Truman's veto of the Taft-Hartley Act, making it now possible for states to pass this so-called right-to-work legislation. And a gentleman out of Texas named Vance Mews, who is a bigot and a racist and a segregationist, takes it upon himself to essentially ride all over the South and advertise that the great opportunity of right-to-work legislation is to prevent African Americans from working in the same jobs and the same companies and the same organizations as white people. And he is absolutely unabashed in his racism. And if you look at the states that were the first states to adopt this so-called right-to-work legislation, it's the states of the segregationist South. Now, you know, again, you and I were talking about the difference between proof, cause, and correlation. Who knows what the actual on-the-ground reality was, but if you just look at the evidence, you can see that there are some that right-to-work legislation grew in the root, grew in the earth, grew in the soil of racism. It comes out of that. It appeals subliminally to the notion that we need to keep these people apart, whether they're black or brown or whatever. That we are that Mr. Mews and his segregation crowd were trying to avoid the opportunity that unions created for equal opportunity for all people. That is still part of the historical record of this so-called right-to-work movement. It doesn't get mentioned. It doesn't get talked about. Nobody brings up the fact that the Koch brothers, for that matter, their father was one of the founders of the John Birch Society, also known for its segregationist and racial inequality. So when you look at the history of this stuff, and I'm not trying to call people names. I'm not trying to call people out and say, if you support right to work today, you're a racist. But I believe that what people need to know is that history is still alive in the United States today. And history from 1947 sounds like a long time ago, but the shadow of that racist background is something that people need to know about. And if they disavow it, great. Let's have it on the record that this is something that we disavow. We're all opposed to racism, and that's not what this is about in 2015. But let's talk about it. Let's make it something, particularly, let's make it something that we can talk about publicly, particularly in the light of the things that have surfaced in this country recently around race and policing, urban violence. You know, these are really deep-rooted American...
Education,
poverty, the growth of the gap between the rich and the poor in this country. There is always a... There's always a blend of issues of race, class, opportunity. How do we make America live up to its great promise of equal opportunity for everybody? If that's what we're about in New Mexico, and it should be because we have one of the most diverse states in the country, then we ought to be doing everything we can to preserve opportunity for people, not create more roadblocks for people.
I think there's another dimension here that keeps coming up when we look at the fact that the United States is shifting demographically to where it will soon no longer be a white majority country. And I think there's a lot of people who, though they would never admit it, want white rule even if it's not a white majority. So if you want white rule but you're not a majority, then you're going to have to basically have a non-democratic system. It happens everywhere. Guatemala, it's run by a small number of families of European origin who rule over the indigenous people all around them, who are the vast majority, not a democracy. Call it what you want, call elections. And I mean, I feel like the United States is in danger of moving in that direction if you have essentially an oligarchy, a system run only by wealthy white people.
Yeah, your knowledge of Guatemala exceeds mine by light years, but the facts on the ground in the United States suggest that we are constantly struggling to maintain the promise of democracy, and that effort doesn't come easy. A couple of things are going on at the same time. We touched on this earlier, Mary Charlotte. We're talking about the transformation, the transition of the U.S. economy. That's scary. That's scary for a lot of people. It's scary for people who thought they knew how the world worked, and now it doesn't work that way anymore. In politics, the same kind of transition is going on from a world that was largely run by a group of people who thought they were in charge. In the case of the Republican Party, I don't think it's out of line to say it's largely white men in business suits who feel like they've got control of the Republican Party and of the country. Mitt Romney was a candidate who really represented that. He's not far off from what the Republican Party is about. And so when he stands up in the last presidential election and talks about the makers and the takers, you know, there's a guy who ran Bain Capital and made a lot of money as a very, very smart, tough businessman. That's the Republican Party.
And they have, as far as I can tell, no real idea of whom they're exploiting. They're kind of like, there's a lot of walls and layers between them and the people who are at the bottom of the economic scale.
I think it's fair to say that the worldview is limited to the people that they spend time with. That's true for all of us. We know who we know, and we don't know who we don't know. In the case of a political party, it seems like they've created a very narrow base for themselves. But here's where it gets dangerous, and you talked about the threat to democracy. With ALEC, with the Koch brothers saying they're going to put $1 billion into the next election cycle, now all of a sudden you've created something that is essentially an independent political arm of a small group of wealthy individuals. And in New Mexico, if you look at this current legislative session and you look at the bills that have been introduced by the governor and the Republican majority in the House, there's a substantial number of their priority bills that were drafted by ALEC. So we've essentially seen the Republicans in New Mexico, who weren't in power in the House since Dwight Eisenhower was president. So you would think they would have an agenda based in New Mexico that was good for New Mexico. And instead, what they've done is simply to import ALEC legislation into New Mexico and attempt to force feed that into our system. In a state where we have enormous diversity of population, where our economic system, the basis of our economy, is very different from other states. We need something that's tailored to New Mexico's needs, to New Mexico's small and medium-sized companies, to New Mexico's population, to the folks who are in poverty, struggling here, to the number of people who are adults and need literacy help. These are things that you would think, if you'd been out of power since Dwight Eisenhower was president, you'd have a bunch of things tailor-made to New Mexico's needs. And instead, what we're being force-fed is all of this stuff that is out of state and has no relevance to our situation today.
I've been told, and I don't know too much about this firsthand, that there is kind of a split between homegrown Republicans and Alec Koch brothers types of Republicans.
Yeah, I think that's a fair treatment. I think the Republican Party is at war with itself in some cases. I think because of what you said earlier, and you were spot on about the power of money, in politics, the homegrown crowd is often overwhelmed by the financial resources of the national ALEC, Tea Party, Koch brothers folks. Money in elections is so powerful today. You can cover up anything. You can bury your opponent in bushels of money. And so if you're a legitimate, you know, Main Street Republican, and your old school, like my brother-in-law up in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, he grew up in Glenwood Springs. He was the first citizen. He's a small businessman. He's a Barry Goldwater Republican. Good man. He would be buried under the onslaught of out-of-state money and out-of-state legislation. So I think even, you know, if you think about who's got something at stake here, I think even the Republicans have something at stake in terms of maintaining something that is, in you know, really true to New Mexico's traditions rather than simply being overwhelmed by money and power and influence from this machine that is headquartered someplace in outside Washington, D.C.
We're talking to entrepreneur and recent gubernatorial candidate Alan Weber. Now, I'm not going to say that the Democratic Party, either in New Mexico or in the United States, has really done a great job defending democratic values. Since Clinton, in a lot of ways they haven't. There have been real problems with labor, with immigration, with the environment, and many people think about voting Democrat as the lesser of two evils rather than as something you can really get behind. And I'm not dissing you as a Democratic candidate, but there are real problems with the party. But when you look at the other side, and when you look at what this, as you call it, machine, big money Republican agenda is about, it doesn't seem healthy. It seems like it's ultimately a kind of self-destroying monster in which one of the first casualties is the environment that actually sustains and nurtures all of us, things like watersheds and groundwater, things that are really important in New Mexico, things like clean energy versus fossil fuel energy, which is in danger of genuinely warming the planet into a kind of unrecognizable oblivion. A one-party system which will end up inevitably in chaos, revolution, hunger, and all kinds of social diseases and physical diseases and all of that. What are they thinking?
Most people, even people who are very, very smart and very, very powerful, are thinking about short-term advantage. They're not
quarter. Is it really the quarterly profit thing?
Yeah. It's maybe not even quarterly. It's today, tomorrow, and the next day, and what do we do right now that takes advantage of the opportunity? And very, very short-term thinking. And it's not really even what's best for the system at large. It's what's best for me right now. And that I understand that. I get that. Adam Smith wrote famously not one book but two. And the one that everybody remembers is the one that talks about the power of self-interest. The other book was all about the power of community interest. And these are constantly embedded in the battle for the soul of America and for the way we try to combine democratic values with capitalism. It's a great struggle. And if you love history and if you love business and you love entrepreneurship, you can see it as an ongoing tension. The thing you say about the Democratic Party, you don't have to tell me about it. I think the Democratic Party is constantly needing to reinvent and reimagine itself. What's exciting about New Mexico for me as a Democrat here is in a state with 2 million people and so much diversity and so much change going on, the Democratic Party can be a real force for reimagining what's possible. So I look at the demise of the Republican and Democratic Party from what they used to be, and more people don't consider themselves either. More and more people consider themselves independents. To me, that says we're living in a time where entrepreneurship is alive and well in politics as well as in business. An entrepreneur is not somebody who starts a business. An entrepreneur is somebody who thinks, to borrow from Steve Jobs, thinks different about solving a problem or providing a service. So politics, government, can be entrepreneurial. People who run for office can think like entrepreneurs, can think about combining different elements into a new amalgam that really challenges the status quo.
Is that happening?
Yes, it is.
What does it look like?
Well, it's different all over the country, but if you look at somebody like the oldest governor, Jerry Brown, is incredibly entrepreneurial. He's willing in some cases to be a old-school Democrat, raise taxes in order to bail the state out, and also be an entrepreneur and think creatively about the transportation and energy needs of California. There's a friend of mine in the state of Michigan who used to work for then-Governor Blanchard, who's got a website about the future of Michigan and how Michigan needs to think differently about its capabilities, not just as the headquarters historically of the auto industry and machine tools, but as a source of innovation and creativity, and government can be a player in that. So I think if you go back and kind of revisit the threads you and I have been talking about, this is a time of real transition and transformation in the United States as a whole. In New Mexico, given the state of our economy, the lack of a recovery, the lack of job creation, the fact that so many of our young people are leaving New Mexico for opportunities elsewhere, this is a time for great entrepreneurial, innovative thinking about government, about business, about the way they work together, about nonprofits. All of these things are being reinvented, and New Mexico could be a real center for that if we want it to be.
What would that look like to you? I mean, what are some actual examples of how New Mexico could reinvent itself?
Well, let's talk about some of the things that are deeply embedded in the state's history. Historically, New Mexico was proudly a state of agriculture, farming, ranching. In the wake of World War II, everybody knows that we became a center for physics and the labs. What they don't know is that during World War II, New Mexico reinvented its agricultural output to be smaller output but higher quality. So that was something that is embedded in our history. We are a state with real agricultural chops. And, you know, the state question is red or green. So in a state where that's our question, why are we not taking advantage of the huge interest in high-quality food, organic food, healthy food, farm-to-table, restaurants built on that sort of local produce? We are doing it, but we're not doing it as much or as well or as visibly as we should. A real entrepreneur talks about branding. We ought to be branding New Mexico as the future of sustainable agriculture. We ought to be proud about our history, and we ought to be making more of it.
Despite our water shortage and continuing water shortage with climate change.
Because of it. I mean, that's another opportunity. I worked for a number of years at a place back east called the Harvard Business School, which is known...
I've heard of that.
It's called the West Point of Capitalism, so I'm always amused when people think I'm some sort of a left-wing radical. But Harvard tells you that there are two ways to make money. One way is to take advantage of things you have a lot of, and the other is to take advantage of things you have a little of. We ought to be the state that is taking advantage of solar, above and beyond almost any state in the United States. At the same time, we ought to be a pioneer in water technology, water management, and the future of water. That feeds into an agricultural future. That feeds into a tourism future. These pieces fit together into a strategy.
Are you running for something?
I'm running to make New Mexico a better place. I think we've got so many opportunities. When I did run, one of the things I kept saying on the campaign trail was New Mexico's future is hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
And it really is. It really is.
You could say that of the whole United States in so many ways.
You could. You could. The thing that's clear to me is that, like Tip O'Neill, the late great Tip O'Neill used to say, all politics is local. You see it clearly at the level of a community or a city or a state. At the national level, it's so blended, it's so large. That's why when I talk about New Mexico's economy, I don't talk about New Mexico's economy. I talk about 9 microeconomies of New Mexico. Because when you break it down into those chewable bites, talk about agricultural farming, talk about solar energy, wind, renewable resources, water management technology, high-tech tourism, entertainment. We just saw Better Call Saul premiere and the switchboard lit up all over America, right? And people may or may not like the image, but the fact is that we are becoming a great place to do entertainment. And those are good jobs.
Now, here's the thing for you. As a capitalist, as an entrepreneur, there is a fundamental issue with capitalism, which is that it requires ongoing growth. We're in a time where we need, for the sake of the planet, for the sake of our waterways and our land and air, to consume less, to live more modestly, to stop growing and really start shrinking in lots of ways that are important, and that's antithetical to capitalism, and I get that. I mean, how do you think about that?
I think about it a couple different ways. First, there's a terrific book about the history of capitalism that points out, first and foremost, the reason so many other economic systems have failed is that they don't have the capacity to adapt to new circumstances. Whereas done correctly, capitalism is the most adaptive economic system we've ever invented. So the good news is that unlike, say, Marxism, communism, socialism, they tend to be a we've got it right, now do it the way we told you to do it system. Capitalism historically has been a continuously evolving and changing way of making a living and putting people to work. So the challenge of adaptation is really hardwired into capitalism as a system. Second is, assuming that you're right, and I think there's a lot of evidence that says we do need to make dramatic changes in our way of life, the best way to do that is through a capitalist system. And by the way, that opens up huge opportunities for people to go to work and make a living, and make a good living. If we actually put people to work solarizing New Mexico, do you know how many jobs we'd create? If we actually created an industry around water conservation, water management, and the technology of a low water future, we could be a state that exported not only the manufactured product, but also the knowledge and the wisdom and the capability. And so you begin to grow an economy around a different kind of future. It doesn't mean that the jobs are the same jobs, and that's where historically we've had to adjust. We've had to do things like trade adjustment assistance as jobs disappeared in the manufacturing realm because they moved overseas. There was kind of insurance policies to make sure people didn't go completely off the rails with their personal lives. But the opportunities to adjust to a different future always create new jobs and new opportunities. That's why education is so important. That's why flexibility is important. And that's why, frankly, stop doing things that are stupid is so important. You know, one of my friends from when I published a business magazine is the guy Jim Collins, who wrote Good to Great. And one of Jim's sayings in Good to Great is most CEOs, most leaders have a to-do list. The best ones have a stop-doing list. So in the case of New Mexico, we need a stop doing list.
What's on that list?
Stop arguing about right to work. It's a waste of time. The governor of Wisconsin, who is an enemy of labor, has said that right to work is a distraction and he's not going to pursue it. So we should stop wasting precious time, energy, political capital, pursuing things that are bad for New Mexico. Stop doing that and use the time and energy to create a program, an agenda for New Mexico that fits New Mexico and puts us in the lead. We should be the most sustainable state in America. We could do it. We should be the state that leverages diversity more than any state in America because, as you said, the United States in the future is going to look more like New Mexico. We're here first. If we got it right, people would study what we're doing right.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I think the United States could be a leader. We have this crazy multicultural, multi-ethnic history, slave history, genocide history. We've got all the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we have all sorts of subcultures in which we actually work and live together in happy harmony. And we could be the world leaders of that. We haven't gotten there yet, but it's something that I think we have more potential than almost any other country in the world.
We are still the country that has that opportunity.
Let's talk just a little bit more about the right to work. There is a paper about right to work in which it lists the 10 states with the worst quality of life and the 10 states with the best quality of life, and they illustrate something which is called the 80-20 rule.
Yes, yes. It's an interesting study. The OECD actually did this piece of work. Organization for Economic... Help me here.
Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
Okay. So the OECD did this study, and they were looking at quality of life, not just in the United States, but around the world. But they did rank America and our states by quality of life. 8 out of the top 10 states for best quality of life are not currently in the so-called right to work category. 8 out of the 10 states at the bottom are in the right to work category.
So now, worst quality of life is correlated 80-20 with right to work, and best quality of life is correlated 20-80.
It's correlated.
Yeah.
You said earlier to me you wanted to be fair, so let's be fair. There is a difference between correlation and causation.
Yes, we know this. Yes.
And so if we're actually going to not use statistics to trick people, we should say, we can't prove that because you're a right-to-work state, your quality of life plummets. But a lot of the states that have adopted the right-to-work legislation do so because they are bottom feeders. They already have a lot of poor quality of life elements, and they think, what the heck, we're already so bad off, let's add this to our litany of arguments for trying anything to make it better.
And I think you made a very good point before, which is that the companies that will come into a quote-unquote right-to-work state are the ones that are least likely to want to give the kinds of benefits that everybody wants. And the second they get a better offer from somebody else, somewhere else that has even worse labor standards, they'll go there and leave you high and dry.
Exactly. It's a bottom-feeding strategy. And let's go back. Let's connect the dots one more time. So we're living in an economy that's driven by knowledge, education, skills. In fact, if you talk to people in the business world, where I used to hang out, they'll tell you they don't even look at right to work. They look at the quality of the workforce, the training, the skills, the education. They'll look at logistics. They'll look at infrastructure. How good is your high-speed internet? That's what they care about.
And also programs like the film incentives here in New Mexico and rebates and stuff like that.
If it's very targeted and if it's very focused, then they're interested. But something that's generic, like right to work, doesn't even show up. So what ought we to be doing? You know, you asked me before, what's the future look like if we're going to play the game smarter? The answer is, instead of telling people, we have such a lousy workforce, you can get them for practically nothing, we should be saying to people, we're investing in our workforce, we're investing in all kinds of training and skilling programs. We've got a great workforce that you're gonna want so much, you'll pay them above minimum wage because they'll add value to what you do. That's the future. And instead, I don't understand the logic of saying we're going to create better paying jobs by having jobs that pay less.
Right.
That's an argument that escapes me.
Right. Or a few more jobs, but they're the jobs that require you to take an extra job in order to make ends meet, which means that your performance in the job is going to go down.
And you have no loyalty to your job.
Right.
You know, the real thing that great management thinkers all know is that the company's culture is its greatest asset. And the culture consists of the way you treat your people and the way your people reward you for treating them well. That's why even Fortune magazine has its annual issue where it talks about the best places to work. Because people with choice, workers who have skills and talent and ability, they'll choose to work at a place that treats them with respect and with dignity, and not just with a good wage, but with a good culture. And what we're advertising with Right to Work is we don't believe in any of that.
We're talking also, you're talking about making long-term investments. You can't just say, oh, we're going to train everybody and in a year we'll have a great workforce. I mean, we're talking about really fundamental educational investment which bears fruit over decades rather than months or years.
It's a both-and strategy. I think you do some things in the short term. You pump up some programs that you know are in industries or parts of the economy that are growth sectors and where there will be a real demand for people very, very quickly. And you also begin to create a long-term investment strategy of all kinds, in people, in infrastructure, in quality of life, in the assets that New Mexico has in terms of sunshine and land and history and culture and food. You invest in those things short-term and long-term, and you create a return on investment today, because nothing convinces people that you're right. Nothing convinces them more quickly than a win. So you need some short-term wins. But don't get confused about short-term wins versus a longer-term strategy.
So we've got just a minute or two left. You were bitten by the political bug. You ran for the Democratic nomination for governor, came in second. A lot of people in this town were very disappointed by that. What's next for you?
Well, I think that the stuff we're talking about today, Mary Charlotte, is alive and well in New Mexico. We've got a lot of work to do here. And what I saw in my campaign, and it was a great experience, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, anybody who cares about the quality of life in our state should run for something. Doesn't have to be governor. Anything. Get involved. Democracy works when we work at democracy. It's like going to the gym. So I've gotten bit by the bug in the sense that I think it matters. I think our state has huge upside potential that we're not realizing. I think leadership counts at all levels, not just at the level of governor, but at the level of going up to the legislature and being a leader who shows up to testify. That's a form of leadership, grassroots leadership. So my goal going forward is to stay involved and to keep my hand in the game, my oar in the water, and try to make a difference. My wife and I are here in New Mexico to stay. This is the last stop on the train, and I want to be a part of making the future better.
Alan Weber, thank you so much for being with
us
on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Rachel. Yeah. What a great conversation.